Welcome to It's Not So Black and White, a podcast where we explore difficult topics with a desire to understand why we think and feel the way we do. I'm your host, Coach John McLernan, and each episode I bring you a guest who brings a challenging topic for us to shine a light on. This podcast is also broadcast live on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So on whatever platform you follow myself, Coach John McLernan, you have the opportunity to participate in this discussion during the live stream. We encourage your participation both by commenting and asking questions. This podcast is about exploring the human experience behind the ideas with compassion and critical thinking. So let's dive in. Welcome back to It's Not So Black and White. It is my pleasure to be interviewing for a second time, Alan Smith. We got to interview first on my other podcast, Between the Before and After, but I was so touched by the topic as I became more aware of the scope and scale of it as it presently exists in today's world that I asked Alan if he would be gracious enough to give me another interview because I want to shine more of a light on this. And I feel like I'm starting to become more passionate about it as I become aware that this exists as a problem, because really, I think my own ignorance, and a lot of us are ignorant of the scale of it, and we want to shine a bit of a light on that tonight. So I'm going to turn over to Alan and just let you introduce yourself and kind of what it is that you do and maybe where we are presently with this fight that we're in.
Great. Thanks for having me back, John. It's my goal to be on all three of your podcasts at one point. Get the hat trick. Make the circuit.
Yeah.
We'll see if I get invited back for a third time. But name is Alan Smith. I'm the executive director of an anti-trafficking agency based in Los Angeles, California, called Saving Innocence. And my co-author, Jessica Midkiff, and I wrote a book called Men Fight For Me, which you've read. There it is. You're holding it up. There it is.
There it is. We've got a copy of it right here. Yep.
Yep. And there's a little website called fightforme.net where the book lives and the conversation lives. And it's shining a light, awareness, exposure to human trafficking. In our setting, we specialize in the child victims of sex trafficking, mm-hmm. which is horrific all in of itself. We could talk about that. And so glad to be here.
Yeah. Just very quickly, you know, if anybody who purchases the book, Men Fight For Me, all of the proceeds are going towards funding the fight against child sex trafficking. Is that correct?
They're going specifically to benefit the survivor. There's six different prominent survivors of trafficking that contribute their story in the book. Mm. And so they're all getting a piece of the book to support them and what they're doing with their career and everything else. So yeah, we're really excited about it. So I can say everyone should just go out and buy multiple copies of the book and get a whole case of them, pass them out, and you'll be doing a good thing on a lot of levels.
Yeah, you know, it says this book is dedicated to the thousands of children yet to be recovered and restored from the horrific abuse of sex trafficking. That in itself is already like kind of a heavy thing. And, you know, kind of, I think my first question is, how do you deal with kind of the heaviness of this? Because you must hear stories and hear about things that are really extremely difficult for us to hear that this is actually happening, especially happening to children. How do you do that and maybe like not get burnt out?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I do a pretty good job at keeping things in perspective. While it is really difficult, honestly, to hear the things and to be involved in the things. I mean, just 2 days ago, I was in a big conversation concerning a 5-year-old, and it's difficult. At the same time, it's such an honor. I feel like it's such a privilege and such an honor to be in that space, making a difference for children who need someone to fight for them. And we have a little mantra around our office, and it's a sign on the wall that says, "Can you believe we get to do this?" And in fact, we just had a team event last month. Everybody got a t-shirt that said, "Can you believe we get to do this?" So, and one hand heartbreaking, on one hand, really rewarding.
Well, I really appreciate that reframe. Can you believe we get to do this? So we get to work to save children, to, you know, and then the name of the organization that you're with is called Saving Innocence, and people can go and visit savinginnocence.org to learn more about the organization and what it is that you do. Mm-hmm. But I actually love that reframe, because I think if we only ever focused on the negative part of it, it probably would start to feel really, really heavy. But this is one way of maybe coping with the atrocities that you become aware of by saying we are saving and we are preventing more of this from happening. We couldn't stop it maybe from getting to where it is, but now we're engaged in the fight against this. And because of this, there are lives being saved.
That's correct. That's absolutely right. There's a hopeful, a positive, joyful side of this horrific, dark tragedy. and it is horrific and dark, but to see these amazing survivors come out the other side and flourishing in a new life that they've been given. And it's really exciting and fun to do that.
Yeah. So, you know, what is kind of the, I guess, in terms of numbers and statistics, just to give people an idea of the scope and scale of the problem as it presently is, because perhaps we might have thought, well, this is just something happening in third world countries, which that shouldn't disqualify it from our empathy and compassion. But there is a sense of, well, if it's happening over there, it's not in my backyard, so there's nothing I can do about it. But the reality is this is happening in our backyard. This is happening in our cities, in our neighborhoods, in our suburbs, things like that. What is the scope and scale of problem, maybe globally first, and then actually in North America itself?
Well, it's been estimated that there's some 40 to 45 million slaves enslaved by human trafficking, and it is slavery. It's it's another person asserting ownership over a different person and forcing them to do stuff they don't want to do. That's very much a slavery. And there's some 45 million worldwide. There's more people enslaved today than at any time in human history. And it's been called the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the world, the fastest growing. And the numbers are just shocking. I know a lot of your audience is in Canada, but you know, in our country, you have some baseball and some basketball and as well. But the gross revenue is estimated of human trafficking to be more than the National Basketball Association, Major League Baseball, and the NFL combined every year.
Wow.
So you think about the three biggest sports industries in the world.
Yeah.
Human trafficking is making more money than those three make.
Right. That's unbelievable. And who is, do we know, like, making the money off this? Are there, you know, are there large scale sort of criminal enterprises sort of at the top of this? Is it run kind of like, you know, the same way, like maybe, I don't know, a mafia or a drug enterprise might be run, or how is this being organized?
Yeah, there's for every trafficked person, there's a trafficker. There's the one who's moving them around and profiting from them. Now, sometimes those traffickers are operating just lone wolf as themselves, and they're controlling one, two, or three girls, maybe, possibly. Mm. And so he would be making all the money that they bring in. It's been estimated that one trafficked for a victim for sex trafficking would bring in roughly $250,000 a year. Which is obviously tax-free. They're not reporting it to the government.
Right.
But on the other side of the coin, there is some cartel involvement, some gang involvement. Just this past week, a couple days ago, we were brought into our Homeland Security was, we were engaged in a conversation with them about a human smuggling effort happening coming through our southern border, and there were a number of young victims. And so that was a bigger operation with more people behind it. So there is that. And then there's also just the single trafficker doing his thing to make his own money.
Yeah. And I mean, in one sense, I can understand that there would be a degree of allure when you put that number out, that one trafficked individual can bring a trafficker up to $250,000 a year. So you think you can traffic four people, someone's doing math and be a millionaire. Yep. Now, you have to be utterly devoid of compassion, I think, and human values to engage in such a practice. But I can see why there is some degree of draw, just understanding human nature here. How does someone become a trafficker? Because I know you've obviously had some conversations in the book. You actually have one called, Conversations with a Pimp or something like that. Coffee with a Pimp. There you go. Which that must have been quite a conversation to try to have going into this, because and maybe you were surprised by what you found when you found this wasn't an entirely like a complete monster.
Right. That was a real challenge, and I was surprised to even get that meeting. And he was very respectful and quick to respond and agreed to have the meeting. And so we met at a coffee shop, and you know, I had a number of questions, and I detail them, as you remember, John, in the book. You know, challenge number one, challenge. There's the things he was saying that were challenging me. Mm. And the final challenge that I had to deal with, and I drove away thinking, okay, now I have to come to grips with the fact that he's a real live person with a face and a name and a story. And what I already knew, and now is confirmed in a face-to-face conversation, is the same conditions which produce these young vulnerable victims, those same conditions are producing the future trafficker. And he went in and told his story about living, he was homeless for a long time, sleeping in a car and didn't know who his father was. And his mom was addicted to something. And, you know, he said a very interesting word to me. He said, "I needed to survive." Now, right. We've heard that word survive from our survivors, from our victims, the kids we're taking care of. Like, they're literally living every single day. I have to survive. I have to be alive at the end of the day and then do it all again tomorrow. And now we got these traffickers are basically saying the same thing. And I'm not excusing his choices and his actions or anything like that, but it started to make sense a little bit.
Well, I think if we're going to understand the problem, we can't just, and I think this challenges a lot of maybe what we might feel, because the first response, I mean, I'm a father, you're a father, and you have daughters, I believe, as well. I have a young son that I'm trying to raise. But this challenges this idea that these are just inhuman monsters that maybe we should just line up and execute, for example, because that might be the first response when they're not humanized. But then when you engage with them as human beings and you try to, because if we're, you know, we can't just go into this and say, because as long as there is demand for this, as long as there's supply and demand, there's going to be a supply. And as long as there's money to be made, I think there's going to be some degree of engagement in this. But if we just go in saying these are inhuman monsters, I think we miss out on an opportunity to understand one of the ways that we can fight against this.
Well, and the hard truth is, if we dehumanize the traffickers by calling them monsters and they don't deserve to live and all those kinds of things, all the things you'd want to do to him, dark alley, we're doing the same exact thing that he's doing to the kids that we care so much about. Right. He's dehumanizing them. He's mistreating them. He's treating them as subhuman.
Yes.
Now, if our remedy is to do the exact same thing to him, ooh, you gotta pause for a minute and say that might not be the answer.
That's so interesting, because it's funny. I just had this thought of, like, you know, superhero stories. Like, for example, I was thinking of Batman. Maybe it's because we're having a dark topic or thing, you know. But I believe, like, Batman doesn't kill anybody, I don't think.
Yeah, it might be right. Yeah.
But so it's this idea that he's fighting crime, and the people he's fighting do kill people, but he doesn't reciprocate in kind. There's like a line there. And so the thought of, we don't want to become the in trying to fight what is a monstrosity, we don't want to become a monster. So we don't want to lose our humanity in the fight against what is an inhuman crime.
Right.
That's actually really, I hadn't thought about it before like that.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not going to go into any detail here, but when I can tell you stories about, you know, 3-year-olds, I could tell you stories about 3-month-olds. And
yeah,
when you start hearing to that level, you think, okay, I got about a dozen friends that are well armed. I'm going to give them the address. Like, this, it just makes your brain go into overdrive where you just think justice needs to be served. And what is the justice for something so egregious?
Yeah.
I don't know that I have the answer for that. I just know that it's a challenge. It's a dilemma that we as a
community sit in. No, you know, of course, I think, like, I have a 14-month-old, and the thought of somebody harming him, yeah. I mean, and you're a father too, like, this, the degree of, I didn't really know, like, how much, like, love, but also, like, protectiveness that I would feel for this little human being, and the thought of someone. And so I try to also think about these other human beings. If this was my child and someone was harming that child, like, what would I do to fight for that, you know? And so, but then we have the other side of the coin, and that is the people, the purchasers of trafficking. Mm-hmm. So the part of the reason this, I think one of the biggest reasons this exists as an industry, is because there are people who are willing to pay money for this. Yep. I don't like to call it a product, but I'm also trying not to glorify what it is. So there's a product, and there's people willing to purchase this product.
Yep.
And I think this is one of the things you're trying to address too. How did we get to the place where we are willing to, and the people that are purchasers, I have like 6 thoughts running around in my head all at once, as you can see, but you said something that we shouldn't call them Johns. No, there's this term John, and my name's Jonathan. I'm like, I don't like that term.
Right.
But you said we shouldn't call them this because John is the name of my friend, or John is the name of my uncle, or John is the name of my neighbor. Yeah. And really, anybody who purchases child victims is actually a child rapist.
Yeah.
Because they are sexually assaulting someone against their will, and someone who is underage. They are not a John. They are a child rapist.
The softest way you could say it would be a sex buyer. They're a sex buyer, a buyer of sex. The most accurate way you could say it would be a child rapist. And we do go into that in the book. Language is important. Mm. You know, in that same conversation of language, you know, you're not going to call him John. You know, a girlfriend sends a Dear John letter when she's breaking up. Well, this, he's raping a child. Let's not even use the same name. But then you've also heard the term probably child prostitute. For a long time, child prostitute was a thing. And in a lot of places, it probably still is. We had a big campaign here in LA about 5 or 6 years ago called, you know, hashtag no such thing. There's no such thing as a child prostitute. Prostitute is a term that suggests choice. It suggests something that an adult person's doing out of their own free will. And the federal age of consent of sexual activity is 18 years old. At least it is in our country. I'm not sure what you're going to
do. It's either 16 or 18, but yeah.
A child can't consent to the felony being perpetrated against them. They're not a prostitute. It's impossible. It doesn't make any sense. And so to demean like the 7-year-old, like I mentioned earlier that we had some conversation, I'm not going to go into it, around a 5-year-old. Like we're going to look at a 5-year-old and call her a prostitute. It doesn't even make any sense.
No. And I agree. The purpose of this conversation isn't to glorify the gory details of what takes place. We don't want to shy away from the fact that horrific things are taking place, but we don't want to get lost in the weeds of going into the minutiae of what's actually taking place. I think it's enough to know that there are children, as you said, as young as 3 months old, you know, 3 years old, 5 years old, against their will, being treated in the most inhumane conditions, you know, maybe being kept in cages and just being assaulted, not just once a week, multiple times a day, against their will. And you talk about survive. You said that, like, a lot of them, they fall into this mindset of, I think about a developing brain. They're literally trying to survive. How can a young brain develop in even a healthy way, have any kind of healthy coping or healthy living and life skills, if every single moment of every day is, I just have to survive this next moment? It just, there's no room really for development, because they're just being, and so I can imagine even trying to reach out and connect and help these people with such damaged emotional and mental health must in itself be tricky.
You know, the human brain is very pliable and moldable at a young age, is developing and growing and learning new things. And when you introduce significant trauma to a young, well, any age, but particularly a young aged brain, through the benefit of, you know, advancing neuroscience, they've been able to look back and it literally rewires the brain to think a certain way, to react a certain way. It's creating a lifetime of struggle for that young child who goes through that trauma. And what we see all the time is, in many ways, that brain, when sexual assault happens on an individual, there's part of their psyche, their emotion, their brain that gets frozen in time at that point. And so their body continues to age. They might get to be 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. But at the point in time when that sexual assault first started at 12 or 13, now there's a part, it's sort of a defense mechanism, if you will. You can bring on some psychologist and they can explain it better than I can. But there's like a defense mechanism, if you will. And it's sort of, it's protecting itself being stuck in a space that was childhood before all this adult stuff started happening to them. And so they're just really, honestly, they're messed up for a long time.
Yeah. Actually, in the previous episode of this podcast, I interviewed a psychologist who herself had interviewed more than 800 terrorists and extremists, which is really fascinating. One of the things that she talked about was trauma gets stored in the part of the brain that doesn't register time. So it gets stored in the timeless part of the brain, meaning that at any given point in time, there can be any kind of cue, whether it's a smell, a sight, a sound, a trigger that boom, in that instant, that person is right back into that traumatized space. And I myself have gone through trauma and PTSD. So I understand what that's like. It can come out of absolutely nowhere and you don't even necessarily have an awareness. And this happened to me as an adult. And I can't imagine what it's like to have this happen to a child with a fragile, you know, I had the benefit of at least being almost 30 years old when it happened to me, where I'd had some life experience. My brain had reached a degree of maturity and so on, but a child that doesn't even have the benefit of that. So, you know, in the book here, you talk about authentic masculinity. I think this is probably the heart of the conversation here, really, because there's been so many conversations around masculinity and what it means. And so when you say authentic masculinity, I think I'd like to dive into what that means. But maybe first we could look at, okay, what is the opposite of authentic masculinity? So we have a little bit of a background for it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it begs the question. If you're going to call something the authentic version of it, that means there must be an inauthentic version of that same thing. That's why you're calling it out, saying, no, this is the correct version. So what's the incorrect version? What's the
counterfeit?
Counterfeit version. Exactly. The counterfeit version it might look similar to the real thing, but it's a little bit off. It doesn't quite measure up. It doesn't quite match up. It's diminished. It's a cheapened version. It's a untrue version of whatever it might be. So in terms of masculinity, there's absolutely a divisive version of masculinity out there that's ruining the world. A diminished version, a cheapened version, the kind of masculinity that brings oppression and harm rather than bringing health and wholeness. I heard this stat recently, and I don't know where it came from or what it was, but they said 80% of problems are caused by men. And I started laughing. I think, yeah, that sounds about right. And then I thought, it actually might be a little low.
Yeah.
Can you think of a bunch of problems right now anywhere that you're thinking about in your city or the world and think, okay, it's a bunch of idiot men behind that making it happen. You know, half the world's in war over in Ukraine right now. Well, it's a bunch of men making that happen, you know? And so,
I think one of the solutions that gets put forward that I don't really like is, well, we should just get rid of masculinity or diminish masculinity. And I understand, especially coming from the feminine side of the female side of things, this maybe because very often they've been on the receiving end of this counterfeit masculinity, sometimes called toxic masculinity. I try not to use that phrase very much because I understand why it gets used, but I really want to point people towards something to move towards versus to move away from. But I understand why they think, because they've been on the receiving end of counterfeit masculinity, they think, well, the solution is to try to get rid of masculinity and maybe try and introduce more femininity into men. But you're saying actually maybe a different solution is not to hide from masculinity, but look at what is the real version of it look like, because it can be a powerful force for good and we shouldn't diminish that.
The big lie that is being propagated out there, various groups on social media, anywhere, whoever, is that any masculinity is toxic masculinity and harmful masculinity. And my urgent message to the world, if not the men that are listening, that is an absolute lie. Do not buy that lie. Yes, there is a toxic, harmful version of masculinity, for sure. And so it's up to us, and this book is calling men to a higher standard. Step into an authentic, powerful, hopeful, helpful version of masculinity. Let's rewrite the narrative. I feel terrible that a bunch of people, probably more women than anybody, have experienced a toxic, harmful masculinity, but that isn't the version of masculinity that is supposed to be here.
Right.
It's a tweaked version. Something went off a little bit and somebody went off the rails. And so we break that down in the book, and I give my four pillars of authentic masculinity.
Yeah. Well, there's a thought that comes to mind, this word that comes to mind, and that is demoralized. And very often when we hear that, we think about someone who is maybe dejected and discouraged. But I feel like there's another version of demoralized, and that is that we lose some kind of moral compass or anchor or some sort of value to connect to. It's as though we've been conditioned to measure our value in terms of like these moving targets of like, let's say, people's opinions or vanity metrics and things like that, as opposed to true, genuine human values and morals, things like, strength and honesty and loyalty and integrity and so on. Yeah. And so I'm prefacing a little bit about exactly this, these four pillars of authentic masculinity. I'd like to dive into that because I think for men, especially listening to this, it's important to understand that there is something hopeful. Like, I love being to be a protector. Like I love that. And I don't want to lose that. The exact opposite of, I want to use this power for good.
You know, and there's a lot of women that want men to be men. Mm-hmm. And it's getting overshadowed by this other voice that is saying men shouldn't be men, because the version of men they're thinking about is a harmful version. Okay. Well, yeah, we don't want that either.
Right.
So we, a couple of buddies and myself all have boys the same age, and, you know, they were about 5 years old, and we read a great book. I came across a great book called Raising a Modern Day Knight, and I recommend
it. It's on my reading list. Yeah.
Good, good. Anyone who has a boy, a son, you're raising a young man, get this book. It inspired us to go down a certain path. And job number one was to, what's the definition of a man, of a real man? Like, what is a real man? Nobody knows. There's no agreed upon definition. Is it a certain age, 18? Is it 21? Is it the man who has the most sex? He's a man. He's the most of a man. I mean, what is it? Nobody knows. And so we came up with our four-pronged definition. Number one is he accepts responsibility. A real man accepts responsibility. He doesn't run from it. He doesn't shirk his duties. He stands up to the task that's given to him. He does it. He follows through. He completes it. And then more than just the actual responsibilities that are maybe on his plate, specifically, he thinks about his neighborhood, his community, and his town, mm-hmm. and his country, and maybe the world. And yeah. Takes and responsibility for what's going wrong in this world.
And I love that. And you know, there's probably a temptation when people hear that to go, well, I don't want to do that because right. it's uncomfortable and it's hard. And I want to say, well, there's another side to that coin. And that it actually feels incredible to be responsible for something and to accomplish something. There's something in us that I believe there's something in the masculine spirit, really, if we could put it that way, where we really thrive when we're given responsibility and we actually live up to that, or at least come close to it. We're not going to be perfect, but when we have an ideal that we're working towards, there's something that I think at least that comes alive in me. I know that.
Yeah.
And it's actually, well, yes, it is hard. It's also where we discover our strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I said earlier that 80% of problems are caused by men. And I'd say most of those problems are caused by fatherless men. Mm. Little boys that grew up without a dad, either present physically or present emotionally. That's the subset that most of these problems, they had a rough childhood. They got beat by their dad. They got violated. Their dad was nowhere around them. And most of those young boys turn into young men seeking approval from the world, seeking some kind of affirmation, trying to grab and hold on and control things because it was so unstable in their world as a child growing up. So our job, I mean, if we did nothing more than really pour into your own family, like spoiler alert, guys, it starts with you in your home. Look in the mirror and accept all the responsibilities for your son, your daughter, with your wife, your family. And this isn't in any way to any of this, the book, none of it in the book or anything we're going to say, isn't in any way minimizing or diminishing the role of moms and women in the world and in your family. Absolutely not. They play a critical, crucial role. But men and women are different. Newsflash to the world. Men and women are different. And both men and women bring something unique and important. And if you take one of those ingredients out, right? Mm. If you make a cake and you need a certain amount of flour, a certain amount of whatever, and you forget one of the ingredients, it doesn't taste very good.
Yeah. Yeah, so absolutely.
We need men and women. And if you take one of them out, it's not a very good cake.
Absolutely. But I think this conversation in particular is important that it is directed towards men because for the most part, it is women who are on the receiving end of the suffering that comes from this. And, you know, there's a lot of men out there who are going to hear this and say, well, I'm a good man. I don't participate in this. I don't condone this. I have nothing to do with it. I've never even heard about it happening. But there's perhaps we go back to this idea of taking responsibility. It's like once you become aware of the scope of the problem that this actually exists, doing nothing is basically the same thing as condoning it at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a number of fun quotes in the front of each chapter. And one of them is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great German theologian who tried to kill Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
He was taking responsibility for the world. I'm going to try to kill this guy.
Right.
And he says, not to act is to act.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say something is you're saying something. And so, you know, men, we don't have a free pass. None of us do.
Right.
And you may not be like a direct part of the bigger problem or any problems. Great. Awesome. But they're happening all around us. So let's take some responsibility and let's try to fix it. Let's fight against it. Let's combat against it. Let's act. Let's step in the gap and do something and change the world.
Yeah, there's something noble about this. So that the first pillar being taken responsibility. And the other thing I just wanted to touch on is none of this is being shared to make men feel bad in a sense. Well, it's okay. We want to create some discomfort. I hope that people hear what's happening in this world of child sex trafficking so that they feel uncomfortable enough to take action. But this isn't necessarily meant to condemn you to feeling bad, but to say you have something in you that you can be a positive contributor to fighting against this. And it's actually a very noble thing and a very inspiring thing.
Yeah, we're part of the solution. Who doesn't want to be part of a solution to something great? Like if you could find the cure for cancer right now, wouldn't that be great? You probably get paid a lot of money, but wouldn't it be great to know that you cured cancer or something like that? Well, men, there's a lot of problems. Pick one. And the one we're talking about today is a really big one. And it's all over Canada. It's all over the United States. It's all over the world. It's not very far from where you're sitting right now. And we need men to step up. And that leads me to pillar number two. Pillar number two is he leads courageously. So if we're going to step into a fight, into a battle, and this is a battle, it's going to take courageous leaders to do that. Battles, big fights and big battles aren't for wimps.
Right.
We need some men to step up, and it's going to be costly. I don't know. You might lose a friend or two because your friend maybe is a direct part of the problem. Maybe your friend's going to go buy someone for sex. And now that you've learned about this, now that you read the book, Men Fight For Me, and you've learned about what's happening, you're going to step in front of your friend. You're not going to let him go. And he said, what are you talking about? And so it's going to take courageous leadership to push up against something so big.
And if we just take a quick sidebar here and say, like, I think we have in our head a picture of what the buyer is, that there's, you know, some kind of, I don't know, seedy, scummy sort of individual. But I think this isn't actually how this plays out in real life, that it's people that we wouldn't expect, but who in all walks of life, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's clergy, whether it's teachers, whether it's politicians, just your regular, you know, Joe dad, like there is no like one, I think, unique profile of a buyer or a purchaser. There's actually, you know, we would be shocked, I think, to learn that there's so many different buyers. Why do you think that is?
There's that many broken men wandering around this world, trying to fill a gap, trying to fill some kind of an addiction, a need. It's a, like you said earlier in the beginning of this podcast, it's a supply and demand issue. There's a huge demand. There's a huge demand for sex, and those that can profit off that are going to recruit the vulnerable and make them available. One of my great friends, who's a contributor in the book, her name is Ori. You can read her story in the book. She contributes quite a bit. She talks about being as an 11 and 12 year old trafficked across the street from Disneyland, and the customers were dads that were in the park with their families, with children the same age as her. And they would make an appointment through the ways they did that. And you'd have some man walk across the street, maybe leave his kids and wife in the park while he's going to go take a nap or get on a call he has to make for work or something. He shows up in this motel room and rapes an 11 or 12 year old, puts his clothes back on, goes back into the park, rides the It's a Small World Matterhorn. It's like regular guys at Disneyland and regular guys at the restaurant. For all of you guys listening right now, I say the odds are high, you know, a sex buyer.
Yeah, that actually just sent a bit of a shiver down my spine. Like some people watching will have noticed that, but just the thought that it's like that pervasive and almost like that close to being in plain sight.
Yeah.
That it's, and I think, you know, you'll find, you know, this a lot better than I do. You look at all the big sporting events, whether it's the Super Bowl or the Stanley Cup or the World Series or, pardon me, even just a regular sports game, you've got a lot of testosterone, a lot of men coming to be a part of these things. And so this is probably an area where you would expect you would actually see a spike in these sorts of things. Is that the case?
Absolutely. It is. Yeah, for sure. The NBA All-Star game was in LA a couple of years ago. And I mean, I got a picture on my phone. I wouldn't reveal it here, but that one of the girls that we're working with, young girls, has a picture of her holding a fistful of money that she's been working around it used to be called the Staples Center in Los Angeles on game night. We had a spike in our calls. The World Series was in LA in the Dodgers. And we have a spike in our emergency crisis calls that we go on as part of our work in and around the World Series. It's just, it's not necessarily that it's a sports event. What it is, it's a large event where there's lots of men who have a little extra money in their pocket. And it's just like a percentage thing. I don't know what the percentage is, but you fill a stadium with, you know, 60,000 people, half or maybe three quarters of them are men, and they're out on their Friday night or whatever night, and it's kind of their entertainment. And there's a big enough handful of broken men that have gone down a path of addictions. They probably started looking at pornography when they were a child. Mm-hmm. Their boundaries have been expanded. They have, in a sense, sold that part of their soul. They've given up, and they're just going down that path. And the only things that get them out is if they get arrested or worse. But and there's going to be plenty of supply to meet that demand in all those kinds of venues.
Right. And you know, to bring it back to this leading courageously and being courageous, I think the one thing that we should also emphasize is this is not necessarily advocating for anybody to go and directly intervene if they see something like this taking place. But maybe we should just quickly touch on that, because I think this does connect to courage and being courageously a part of this fight. If someone becomes aware that something like this is taking place, you know, what might be a meaningful or useful course of action?
I would gather all the intel from a distance that I could if you saw a car and a license plate or something like that, but I would call the police right away. And I'm not sure what your response is in your part of the world, John, but we would call 911 here and call the police and tell them what you're seeing. And most, at least the bigger cities, have a response for that. And at least now they do. The problem is, and you're absolutely right, we would not encourage courageous, awesome, strong men to step in the middle of an active situation right there, because the trafficker is not far away. He's mm-hmm. probably watching, and he's going to think that his girl that he's controlling somehow signaled you that she needed help and you came in to help. Well, now that's going to be held against her. She's mm-hmm. going to get beat up or worse, because it's going to look like she's the snitch, even though maybe she had nothing to do with it. It was just you right. being, you know, the courageous man. So we wouldn't recommend that you intervene directly in a situation like that. And call the police and give them all the information that you saw.
Now, would there be some, I guess, the victims caught up in this who, when they're offered a way out, would actually be resistant to a way out?
There absolutely would be. And you kind of peel back the psychology of what's going on. And I know you read the book. There's a whole chapter on the victims. And then we go into that. You're setting me up here, I think. And so many of these kids that are victims have experienced an early childhood abuse, oftentimes a sexual traumatic abuse, age 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And now this trafficker sees the vulnerability on this 12-year-old, 13, 14-year-old at a bus stop, at the mall, whatever. He can just sense the vulnerability. And he starts telling her everything she's ever wanted to hear, how beautiful she is, mm-hmm. how amazing she is. I would love to date you. Let's date. I'll protect you. She's never been protected. She's never been loved. Mm. He's saying all those things. Next thing you know, in her mind, she loves him and he loves right. me back. She thinks he loves him back. And he's the only one that has loved her thus far in her life, for the most part.
Right. Cause she's so maybe now, never experienced authentic sort of masculine love, right. like from a father or from, you know, and probably maybe too young to be in a meaningful romantic relationship at this point.
And she can't tell the difference between the good version and the bad version, because she's never seen the good version. There's nothing right. to compare and contrast. And so when somebody comes in and breaks up what's happening and they take her away from that, she may not be ready to leave. She's like, this is my boyfriend. I love him. I'm gonna do whatever I can because he takes care of me. Like, she might be really manipulated and brainwashed. You know, there's something called the Stockholm syndrome. Where that's where the person who's the captive begins to form a bond and a relationship with the captor. The person who's controlling them and imprisoned them, we call it trauma bonding. There's a bond that's mm-hmm. happened around all this trauma. So she may not be ready to go. And not only right. that, even if she wants to go, she's been trained and taught that if she does run, that he's going to find her and most likely kill her. And we've seen that happen. We've had a handful of our kids get murdered, one just last week. And because they step out of line and they got taken away by the police. And if they didn't run back, we've had kids jump out of cars, out of moving cars when we're taking them someplace safe, because they got to get back to their trafficker. Because if they don't, they're going to get killed or beat up really badly.
Right. Right.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I mean, that just like makes my stomach sink, just the thought, especially because we're probably talking again about like young, maybe even children being murdered. And again, that's a really, really, really difficult thing to hear, that this would actually happen. So then how does a victim who's being trafficked, what and I suppose every story is a little bit unique, but is there something that we see that moves someone towards wanting to escape and being ready and willing to escape? Because you mentioned, I guess, some of the kids that you work with. Are there sort of like people who are still currently caught in a trafficking situation who you're in contact with, but they're not, mm-hmm. you know, like they're still, you can't necessarily pull them out yet. Is that yeah. the case or?
It is a case. There's a little model called the stages of change, and there's about a seven little step piece of the, like a pie chart, if you will. And they have to have progressed through that in order, if they're not ready to leave, it doesn't matter what we do, they're going to run back. They're going to jump out of a moving car to get back because they don't see any other option. Right. So there is a certain amount of time, you know, there are a lot of factors. How old were they when they first began to get trafficked? How long did it go? How severe was it? But there's a certain amount of time when, even with that victim, she can understand that this guy does not have her best interest at heart. Mm. Like, I wish I could get out. I wonder how I could get out. But you got to be real careful because you're going to get in trouble if you try to get out. So that there is a time when they would not be a welcome escapee. And then when they cross that line and they're looking for someone to help them get out. You know, the title of the book, you remember the chapter, Rachel in chapter 3, she says, I couldn't fight for myself anymore. I needed someone to fight for me.
Yeah.
So she wanted to get out. She couldn't see any way to get out. And mm-hmm. I needed someone else to fight for me. And that's what inspired the title of the book, for men, let's get up and join this fight and fight for these kids.
And so going back to authentic masculinity, we've had pillar number one, which is take responsibility. Pillar number two, which is lead courageously. Yeah. What is pillar number three of authentic masculinity?
Number three, he lives a life of service. So an authentic man, a real man, a helpful man, a man who's bringing health and wholeness to the world is coming to serve. One of the guys in chapter 9, when all these guys give their couple paragraphs on what their definition of authentic masculinity, one of the guys says, "When as soon as a man takes, he loses all credibility." So the idea is we need men to show up ready to serve, ready to give, ready to bring value, not take value. We're not trying to gain a profit from being a man. We're trying to build other people up. And so that's the idea there, that we need men to serve. So far, this sounds like a world I want to live in. We're accepting all our responsibilities. We have courageous leaders standing against the injustices. And now we have men coming humbly, ready to serve their fellow man or woman. And spoiler alert, guys, this all starts with us at home.
Right.
Your life and your family.
Yeah. And again, I think now, because here's what comes to mind is maybe the, I want to say like the cultural depictions of what masculinity looks like. And we might hear something like service and go, well, I don't want to do that because I've seen music videos, you know, in a particular genre where they show their idea of a man, you know, flashing money and diamond rings and smacking women on the rear end and things like that. And the idea of like a call to service, well, why would I want to do that when like over here, you've got this person saying that I'm a millionaire and I smack women around. And we actually let that be published and played on TV. And why there isn't like more outrage against like this open misogyny, I don't know. And somehow we've even got it so twisted that we sometimes treat it as though it's like we're empowering women by misogynistically mistreating them.
Well, probably because it's mostly men running the TV networks and producing the movies, right?
Right.
80% of the problem are caused by men. There's one of them right there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, so when we say a life of service, you know, again, it's not one of like, I could say like abject servitude where you're in suffering and constant deprivation, but actually the call to service is one that's again, extremely fulfilling. You live with a sense of purpose. Like there's so much, like, I think what people don't understand is that when you serve others and bring value, you gain. Like I know even in my own business, when I come with a heart of service of genuinely wanting to help somebody, you know, yes, I do this to make a living. Yes, this is what I do. But when I was in it for just what I could get out of it in terms of money, I wasn't truly helping people. But when I went into it and said, this is a value exchange and I need to bring value through my service, that's when things changed for my business. So in your eyes, what does it look like to be like a man of service?
Well, like I said, it starts at home. And so as the man, the male, not dominant, that would be the negative side. You try to dominate that male figure. You're going to serve your wife. You're going to serve your children. Now they're your children. They have to do their chores, have to do their things. Mm-hmm. You're going to serve your family, and you're going to, part of that is protection. And part of that is you're going to, you know, make enough money where they can eat and do some recreation. You know, you're just going to look for different ways where you can give and not take. And mm-hmm. it shows up a million different ways. And then you start thinking about that. Well, what about my neighbor across the street? You know, I've got an elderly lady down the street. I'm thinking about maybe I should help her bring her garbage cans in, right? Would that right. be such a big deal? You're just looking for little ways. We're not drawing attention. It's not service anymore if you shine a spotlight on yourself.
Right, right.
Quietly serving in the shadows, helping mankind get better and helping our communities get better. I bet your elementary school in a few years when your little guy is in kindergarten or first grade or second grade, they'll need to do something down to school on a Saturday and yeah. fix up the playground or something like that. Well, you're the first one there, John. You're the first one there. You get a couple of buddies because we're going to serve our community. We're going to serve the school and therefore serve our children. And it's just a much better way to live when you're giving instead of taking. And that was our third sort of tenet, our third pillar of authentic masculinity.
Yeah. Well, that of course then leads to the question, well, what is the fourth one?
We have one more. And this one's a little more abstract, but it's as it stated, it says, he understands that who he is more important than what he does. And so the idea is kind of the internal versus the external. We wanted our boys and things I'm thinking about now is for me, but we wanted our boys to understand that what's most important is the internal things like character and integrity and honesty and follow through and, you know, love and service and all the things that you're going to think on the inside of you that make you, you. Mm-hmm. We're going to spend most of our time and focus on building that. And then the external is not as important. Like you can pick whatever job you want to do. You can be a podcast guy. You could go into sports and play soccer, or you could try to be in the movies or worked out at the corner store like that. We don't really care to our young boys. You're going to follow the path. We're going to cheer you on. I'm going to get you pitching lessons. If you think you want to be a pitcher in baseball, like we'll do those things. But those things are never going to be more important than who you are as a man and the character on the inside. Let's not get it confused here. And you think in the rare example where somebody makes it big, you know, mm-hmm. and makes it big in sports or entertainment or something and make a lot of money and a lot of false flattery comes and they're in the news and the social media. Well, all of a sudden, you know, if you're not grounded internally, you might begin to believe all the false flattery and the lies that are being told to you, the false security of having too much money, all those kinds of things are landmines and traps. So we wanted our boys from a young age to understand who you are on the inside is more important than what you do on the outside. And we get both those things going in the right direction, we're in good shape.
Well, I think I came across a quote recently by Jim Carrey, and I won't get it correct, but it went along the lines of, you know, everybody should have like a month or two living, being rich and famous. Maybe they would need more time than that, but to understand that this isn't the answer.
Right. Yeah.
And
that's right.
That's someone's saying, like, you know, what an interesting career. I don't want to make it about him, but sort of interesting career trajectory that this guy has been on. But it's, you know, I think about a parallel in the Bible and, you know, and that is that of King Solomon, who in the biblical story where he had just immense wealth and riches and everything the human heart could desire. And at the end of it said, it's all vanity and vexation of spirit was what he was describing. In other words, this didn't really meet. This didn't do for me what I thought it was going to do. And I had everything I could possibly desire and I still wasn't happy. And so I think there's a part of this that you're kind of describing here is this idea that like no amount of sort of acquisition or accolade is really going to fill the emptiness. And maybe we could even take one step back and say part of the reason why there are men going out and purchasing children for the purposes of sex is because they're trying to fill some kind of emptiness that they feel on the inside. Yeah. And it's never, you know, no amount of this will ever be enough.
No, that's true. And I remember a quote from, this is, I don't know, 10 years ago or more now, Tom Brady, you know, the big quarterback in American football. I remember after he won the first or second Super Bowl, you know, here's a guy with a, you know, supermodel wife and he's now on top of the world with sports and Super Bowl. And there was some quote, I forget exactly what it was, but it was basically, is this all there is? Like, I thought there'd be more to this. Now, since then he's won five or six more Super Bowls. So maybe, maybe he'd say something differently now, but it was just like, you know, people at the highest peak of their career and their life, there's something more that they're missing oftentimes. And we wanted our boys, and certainly as a group, we had a faith perspective that fits into that definition and that, you know, that part of their internal. And so that was something we wanted them to focus on.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. I think if I understand correctly, that you are practicing the Christian faith, but in this book here, you really didn't make that, you didn't shine a massive light on it. There was definitely an undertone that this influenced some of the things you said, but you did a really fantastic job of really making this accessible to anybody, to all walks of life, to people who follow any sort of philosophy, because I think the central principles that you describe here are really sort of timeless, and they transcend sort of cultural boundaries.
Yeah, everything we just said about authentic masculinity, you could connect that to the Bible and different scriptures and verses, which in my mind and my heart, it does. But on purpose, strategically, we made the book, you know, mostly faith neutral, if you will, because I didn't want any guy who didn't think he was on the inside of having a faith and an understanding that somehow the book wasn't for him and he was somehow disqualified from reading it. I want every man to read this. This is universal. This humanitarian crisis that's happening. And if you're approaching this book and these topics through a lens of faith, great, awesome. But you don't have to be. You don't have to be to find this important. And I don't know if you got as far as the appendix, but I do have a several page section to the church. At one point it was in the book as a chapter. I thought, no, I'm going to move it out of the main body of the book and put it in the appendix. And I have
this is like optional reading. Yeah.
Optional reading, kind of a strong, clear message to the church, their role in all of this chaos and madness, which is a significant role. But you're right. Yeah. It is a faith neutral on purpose.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of as we wind up here, thinking about just practical steps that we can take. So we've talked about some really, really valuable things. And again, I strongly recommend, you know, for those who are watching, you know, Men Fight For Me, it's an outstanding read, very well worth reading. But maybe you're listening to this and you've heard, and now you're becoming aware of the scope and the scale of the problem, you know, 45 million victims of slavery worldwide, probably approaching 500,000 in North America, like just mind-boggling numbers that are really difficult to comprehend. And when you hear the scale of that, I hope that it tugs at something in your heart and you go, okay, I want to do something. Now you said, okay, not to directly intervene, but there must be something that I can do if I want to be a contributor to this, even in the smallest way. Because when we look at the magnitude of the problem, I think there'll be like for any single human being to even try to comprehend the number 45 million humans is already just, it's already like beyond, really beyond our sort of our comprehension.
Yeah.
But it's like the magnitude of solution that we offer, or I should more say the magnitude of contribution that we offer does not have to be equal to the magnitude of the problem, because we're not asking only one person to solve all of this. Right. So any contribution towards this is a positive contribution. So what are some steps that people could take?
Well, it sounds like a shameless plug, but get this book and read it. In the book, we go into great detail in chapter 8, all these solutions possible. And then in the appendix, there's a whole nother list of things you can do today. That's a subset of step one, is to get a little bit educated. Just take a minute, take this interest, this passion. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Get a little bit educated, get on Google, go down a rabbit hole, watch some documentaries, read some books and follow some people. If you go to fightforme.net, which is where our book lives, it's on Amazon, but we have a bigger conversation happening there. A number of the contributors, we have a YouTube channel connected to that. A number of the contributors are kind of interviewing, kind of like we're doing right now. And these are survivors of trafficking. You're going to learn about this thing. All of their websites, a number of the contributors have books. I'd say gobble up some reading, gobble up conversations, and then you'll figure out, okay, this is my lane. Like I think you said this before we started recording, John, like you don't necessarily have a gazillion dollars. You can just fund all the stuff. But what you do have, you got two or three podcasts and you can have a guy like me on your podcast. And I love that idea, because what I say all the time is do whatever it is that you can do and do that. And so get a little bit educated. And then whatever it is, what kind of skill or talent do you have? Use that. And I would say contact a local anti-trafficking agency. If you can't find one, go to savinginnocence.org. We'll be glad to take your contribution. But find one in your neck of the woods. And here's one practical thing I say over and over again. Go to their website, call somebody, find out how many staff they have. There's probably 2, 5, maybe 10 staff, whatever it is. The next time you go down to that grocery store, get a gift card for $10 or $20, whatever it is, for every one of their staff members, like a Starbucks thing. Do you guys have Starbucks?
Sure.
You do, right?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, yeah.
Get a Starbucks card or something like that and mail them or drop them off to the staff. Thanks for doing what you're doing. We appreciate it. We're cheering you on. You don't have any idea what kind of encouragement that's going to be for the people that are laying their lives on the line every day on behalf of these dear victims. Encourage the staff. You can adopt the staff of your local group, become a donor, a monthly donor. There are just some things, practical things right away. And then once you get to know the staff of your local organization, find out what they need. They might be collecting clothes to give away to their kids or diapers. Yeah. Their young victims have babies and they need baby supplies. So there's no shortage of needs. You can connect to me off of fightforme.net. There's a contact. Send me an email and I'd be glad to have that conversation with anybody and steer you in a further direction.
Yeah. And I love that you just speak to just encouraging anybody who is directly involved in the fight, because I imagine for a lot of people, this can feel like a very thankless job.
Yeah.
When there's people you would like to help who don't even, you know, who don't even want your help at the present stage that they're in and so on and so forth. And they meet all kinds of resistance and all kinds of struggle. So anybody who can just contribute and encourage them to keep fighting what is a very noble fight, I think is worthwhile.
And it's around the clock. There's no punch in and punch out, clock out. Oftentimes in the middle of the night, and they're all really heavy, hard situations. So for that local organization that is in your neck of the woods, to know that there's somebody out there that sees them,
yeah, just knows they exist,
appreciates them. What do you guys need? Let me send you some Starbucks or whatever you want to send them.
Yeah,
that'd be phenomenal.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, just as we close out, I mean, you've already shared a lot of, I think, like valuable and timeless wisdom, and of course, I very much appreciate your time. But I just, if there was one takeaway that you could just sort of condense into a little nutshell, a practical, actionable thing for anybody who's listened to this, and I want to say also, if you've listened to it, share this episode. That's a great way to contribute as well. And yes, I'm plugging my podcast, but I think I want to have these conversations. So, what is one practical takeaway for folks listening?
The practical takeaway and the target audience of this conversation for me is men. Of course, we need women involved too, but men, the urgent message is there's a massive, horrific problem out there. And in some ways, we are all part of this problem. So that's good news. That means we're all part of the solution. Yeah. So get off the couch, get off the sidelines, whatever metaphor you want to use. Get in the fight, get in the battle. It doesn't matter how you want to do it. Creep in slowly. Jump all in, get in the fight, because as our dear friend Rachel said in chapter 3 of our book, I needed someone to fight for me. It's like, let's go, guys. What are we waiting
for? Let's go. I love that. Well, Alan, thank you so much again for your time. I greatly appreciate it. And thank you for all the work that you're doing as well.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning into It's Not So Black and White. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, or leave a review, because that helps this podcast to reach more people. It's fascinating to explore the thoughts and minds of those who see the world differently. We don't have to agree on everything in order to engage in civil discourse. So I hope this podcast inspires you to have an open mind and a willingness to see things from another perspective. In this, we can create a hopeful future moving forward.
Whatever your belief system, go and investigate it. Like, really dig down into it. And you can only benefit from really thinking deeply about why you believe something.